This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I'm talking to Mary Vollmer. She's the author of a book called Reliance, Illinois. It's a novel. It's a historical novel that takes place in 1875 in a town called Reliance, Illinois, which I think is made up town. And Mary, this is your second book. Is that correct?
It is, yes.
So I must admit, I have not read your first book, but I think that was also a historical novel, correct?
It was. It was set in California during the Gold Rush, and it started after I began investigating women at the time, because there were only 8% women in the Gold Rush, according to census counts, which made me very curious, being an athlete and often the only girl on the court with a bunch of basketball players. I felt like I knew what it was like to be one of those women alone with a bunch of men. So that was probably the reason why I was drawn to that subject first.
Well, and also, you grew up in what is essentially Gold Rush country. You're from Grass Valley?
Yeah, I am. And so, of course, you grow up with this history thinking nothing much of it. And then I moved away to Wales for graduate school. And suddenly, my own history became important in a way I'd never imagined before. So I think that distance did a lot to awaken me to the fairly rich, albeit not very distant, history of the Gold Rush.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is true when you live around. Although, I think the I don't know what it's like at all growing up in Gold Rush country, but from far away, it seems very exotic. You know. Maybe for you, because you grew up there, not so much.
You know, it wasn't. One of the things I noticed living in Wales is that boys would start playing soccer and their goalposts would be standing stones. So to me, these standing stones would be these tremendous artifacts. And to them, they were a couple of goalposts. So to me, growing up, a Pelton wheel in the town square was something you climbed on and hung your jacket on while you were talking to your friends. It didn't really have any kind of historical significance until I got away from the place and looked back.
Right. Well, but now, okay, so that kind of brings us to Reliance, Illinois. Clearly a place that you're not in and I think don't have any experience in yourself. And Illinois is pretty distant in both geography and time. I mean, 1875, from who you are and where you live. So I'm just curious, what attracted you to the 1870s?
A couple things. One was a mistake I'd made in the first book. And I until the last edit, I had the Mississippi River on the wrong side of Missouri, if you can believe that.
Oh.
My editors were British and didn't know any more than I did, apparently, about where the Mississippi River was. And I became pretty obsessed after that about the Mississippi River and started to read almost everything Mark Twain had written about it and carried with me Life on the Mississippi, traveled there, and had a sense when I got there that there was a story that I wanted to set in this place. And when I started reading on and reading more about the dark ages of the women's suffrage movement, that is after the 15th Amendment passed, which changed the language from all persons to all men shall have the right to vote. That particular time period became very interested in me. It's right before the centennial, and yet women still don't have the right to vote. It's on the upswing of the Jim Crow laws, and it's a tremendous period of drama and unrest, and yet hadn't really been treated in fiction very much. This is a war. The spectacle of war always got the most attention, and I was curious about life and what it might be like in those dark periods after the war. I think, too, at the same time, I was living approximately 10 years after conflict that still isn't over in the Middle East, and seeing the repercussions of that on a daily basis. So I think my contemporary concerns overlapped with those historical concerns in a way that drew me in to the story in a way that, it didn't matter that I hadn't lived there. I felt like I was living in a parallel moment.
Well, and all I did, I mean, obviously all of the, well, not, I've, since I've read it, it's obvious to me, but all the, for people who are listening, almost all of the most important characters in the book are female. And,
yes.
You know, your main character is this young girl named Madeline, Maddie Branch. And we're, I won't give away, you know, any of the story, but, they're in this little town. Her mother and she arrive there. The setup is they arrive there, because her mother marries someone through, which was somewhat typical of that era, you know, mail order bride, but she doesn't want the, mm-hmm. the prospective father, husband to know that she has a child who's 12 years old. So she claims Maddie is her sister. And that's kind of the conceit from which all begins, in the novel. But very, you know, you have many really powerful women characters in the book, and it is, you know, clearly this kind, it is a really interesting period of women's suffrage, where, you know, you can only imagine the difficulties that those women had to face in just in daily life, trying to establish themselves as, viable, you know, as treated seriously. It's just unimaginable. You know, the world we live in today, which is considered to be, I think, incorrectly post-feminist, is, you know, it's, we're not done with this issue. You know, it's still ongoing. That the notion of full agency for women has not really, these people were, you know, kind of prehistoric in that sense. And it's just hard to believe, you know, hard to understand what it would be like to be a strong woman with a mind and ideas and political engagement living in a small town in Illinois in 1875.
Right. Well, and these women, there were women living all the way through the country that did have strong ideas and were vocal, but we don't remember them. They're not recorded in history for one reason or another. One of whom is Mary Livermore, who organized the sanitary fair up in Chicago during the war, the Civil War. And after that experience, had not before then had any interest in suffrage, but after that experience realized that women did have a public position and should have a public position in politics, and spent the next years of her life unsuccessfully lobbying for the vote. I think women's power in this book particularly, you see it revealing itself in a lot of different ways. I think Rebecca, the mother, uses what she has of power and as well as she can. But of course, the limits are tremendous. And a lot of those are because she doesn't have the educational opportunity or the economic opportunity to have any kind of autonomy over herself and her decisions, or her daughter even. I think she does the best that she can for Maddie, but what can she do?
No, that's true. But then by fortunate happenstance, Maddie ends up kind of under the wings of these two other powerful women.
Yeah.
And,
And
that's, you know, I love them. I thought, now did you model them on known historical figures, even though not necessarily directly, but were you influenced by particular women to build those characters?
Oh, yeah. You know, I read a lot of biographies. I read about Victoria Woodhull, Other Voices by Barbara Goldsmith. I read Wendy Bennett's biography of Mary Livermore. I read about Olympia Brown. I think if you, Mrs. French, who's the more intellectual, quieter, more grounded woman of the two by far, she's based on largely on the writings of Olympia Brown, although Myra Bradwell, who wanted to be a lawyer, was huge in the legal scene in Chicago at the time, but never was admitted into the bar. Miss Rose is a mashup of people and women who I've observed in places throughout history. There was a woman named Marjorie Kemp, and I think in the 15th century, who wept for the sins of humanity, and nobody ever could figure out whether she was in earnest, whether or not her tears were blessed, or if this was her way of having some sort of power in her limited world. And I was interested in that with Miss Rose, whether or not her emotions and her motivations are pure, and if that even matters. It even mattered that maybe she had alternative, ulterior motives in all of her altruistic feelings.
Yeah, no, I thought of
it. Go ahead.
No, it's all right. I was thinking about what you just said and relate. You know, one of the things that happens in the story, which I think I can talk about without giving away too much, is there's a local election. And I thought it was very telling that you could almost feel that those characters were connected to our current election cycle. Even though you might not have meant it literally, some of the things you said about them in describing these characters, I thought of people that we are dealing with today.
Well, I won't pretend that I don't use contemporary figures and kind of put them in the past and see how they run around. Mark Twain has the quote, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme." And so I love to look for these little rhymes that pop up everywhere. I also think I'm a bit cynical about the current day. And so in order to comment at all, I have to go back in history and look forward from there. I'm a bit less critical of humanity, I suppose, when I start from a historical perspective.
Well, I was very impressed in reading this book that you, some writers are really good at story, and sometimes their characters are not as fully formed because they're really good at story. And other writers are really good at characters, but sometimes the story suffers because they're really good at characters. But I thought you handled both. I loved your characters. I thought, you know, they were all very, deftly portrayed, that you were able to, you know, describe people and bring them to life, in not too many words, which I appreciate. And, there's a great story. Now, of course, there are a couple of characters that I kind of don't want to talk too much about too much of the book, so I don't spoil it for everybody.
But
there are, you know, there is, and you do wrap things up, you know, at the end, which I think is good, leaving us satisfied with the story and hoping for good things to happen to the characters that we like, and maybe not so many good things to happen to the characters that we don't like. But yeah, I was impressed by that. And, you know, there's the old man who is, the father of Miss Rose, who's in this big house, and he doesn't talk, so you really can't know him in that way. But I thought you presented him really well, and I like the nickname that Maddie gave him, kind of really evocative,
old turtle head.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
So I really liked Madeline. You know, it's tricky to, I think. It's always tricky to write about a young person in a coming of age story. It just feels like it sometimes is difficult to, to get that development without and stay consistent as a character evolves. And I thought that was really well done.
I think I struggled with that at first when I tried to write her from the perspective of a 13-year-old, and that wasn't working when I was doing that. I didn't have the scope and the ability to speak more broadly. And so when I started writing in a retrospective, the older woman looking back, then
yeah,
she just came alive to
yeah.
me.
No, I think you have to do
that. She could laugh at herself.
Right,
yeah.
Right. No, you have to do that. I think it allows you irony. It allows you perspective that she's, but without it sounding like she's telling this story from a high on a hill either, you know, like if the perspective is kind of ahistorical, but it's enough of a distance. Yeah, you're right about that. I was thinking one of the only books that I can think of that takes place in this period written with a main character being a girl is a novel called Caddy Woodlawn. I don't know whether you've ever read it. It is a classic of frontier life. She lives in Wisconsin, and I think it's 1869. where it's still a little bit rough there. You know, Wisconsin was a little, you know, later settled than than Illinois, and but so in 1869, still a little rough around the edges, and it's told similarly from the perspective of Caddy as a grown woman, but she inhabits herself as a 12-year-old, and it's in that way there's a similarity. I hadn't thought of it until just now. Not in no other way, you know. It's not like the stories are the same or anything at all. Sure. But you'd probably
I had a couple models on that, and you know, Harper Lee just passed, but I had Harper Lee's *To Kill a Mockingbird* on my desk constantly, and because she does have that ability to create this a humorous distance between this girl and then slip so discreetly into the experience that the reader is completely in the experience at those moments. And then she backs up, you know, and the narrative voice takes over and we have this grander view and more broad perspective of the town and the time. And then we slip back into that girl, and that kind of intimacy that she managed was what I was hoping to achieve. And that was a model. Home Ground by Lynn Fried is another one that does this. And of course, Charles Dickens, Great Expectations.
Yep.
That's those first 10 pages of Great Expectations has so much humor, even though yet you feel so deeply for Pip. You're rooting for him all the way, but that's a product, I think, not of that dual point of view, where at once following the child, but we're led by the adult voice.
Right.
And it was just, that was very, when I discovered those books as a model, that's when this voice came alive.
Hmm. Well, that's really interesting. Well, one other thing I wanted to ask you about in this book, which I thought was really, you know, is one of the kind of interesting subjects is this idea that the women were involved in sharing contraceptive techniques. They had diaphragms. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't realize that had been going on at that period, that it was a part of the suffragist effort. And of course it makes sense, but I just had not even thought of that. And it was really, I thought that was really evocative that you, you know, it's a natural part of the story. It wasn't forced in any way, but it's very revealing. You know, it humanizes mm-hmm. the women in a really remarkable way. I thought that was great.
Well, thank you. Most people don't know, but vulcanized rubber was developed in the 1830s, I think maybe 1839-ish. And as soon as vulcanized rubber was discovered, they found uses for it that didn't involve any kind of industrial use. And one of the uses was contraceptive products, which before the Civil War were fairly widely advertised, and even in the New York Times. But after the Civil War, there was a movement against quote-unquote obscenity, which was a wonderfully flexible term. And a category into which contraceptives were also cast. So you had this backlash against contraceptives after the Civil War in the name of morality. And for the first time, you had federal morality laws called the Comstock Laws, which outlawed the passage through the mail of anything deemed obscene. So, you know, 10 years, 15 years before this moment in time in the 70s, women may not have spoken openly about contraceptives, but they would have been more readily available. And now you have 10 years later, 10 years after the Civil War, the politics are such that women don't know. They don't have access.
Do you know is there a kind of historical reason why this occurred? What was behind the rise of the Comstock Laws and a kind of movement do you know what that was?
Well, yeah, I mean, kind of. So during the Civil War, men from all over the country were leaving home for the first time, going far abroad, leaving their mothers and their churches and all kind of moral center that they had. At the same time, you had the rise of the publishing industry and the capability of reproducing, mass-producing images, photographic images. And very soon, body pictures were distributed widely, and people were concerned after the Civil War about the degradation of our morals because these images were so widely available. And so the backlash, I think the backlash had two parts. One was a moral backlash, but one was a desire to return to some sort of normality, which of course is nostalgic and false. You can't return to any wonderful normal time before the war because that perfect time you imagine never actually existed. But all the disruption of the war gave people a desire for control and a desire for this more perfectly controlled world that they imagined existed before. And so I think that was part of the rise of the morality laws. Also, you had, with the freeing of the slaves, you had all of these people now who are no longer under your control. And one of the ways you do control people is through social constructs like morality. So I think women were, you know, maybe shackled. It is too strong of a word, but they were placed in a tighter control after the Civil War in a lot of ways than they had been before. There were a lot of laws that allowed more marriage freedoms and more freedom to have property and more freedom to have some sort of profession, but there was also an equal backlash against other kinds of freedoms, like sexual freedom. And of course, I'm speaking largely as a novelist here, so you know, what exists in history, particularly in what exists in the novel, sometimes I get confused, but that was the backbone. That was the background that helped me understand these women at this time in this place.
Right. No, I think that's good. I like to hear that. Well, we talked a little bit before about you possibly reading something from the book. I think that would be wonderful. So could you read a couple of pages?
Sure. Let's see. You know, why don't I just read from the very beginning, and if we have time, I can read a little
sure.
bit
Absolutely.
Later in the book.
Absolutely.
So this is part one, chapter one. I was 3 months from 13 when Mama and I stepped off the carriage in the Mississippi River town of Reliance. We carried between us one tattered carpet bag, a hat box, a balding crushed velvet filled with lace making and sewing notions. And we carried a marriage proposal from a Mr. Lyman Dreyfus. Two other passengers, a consumptive old father and a woman in a foreign-looking dress, heaved their trunks and disappeared into the arms and wagons of loved ones. The coachman hissed low obscenities to his team, and he, too, continued up Grafton Road, leaving Mama and I alone together on the outskirts of a brick-and-mortar town that looked ready to tumble from the limestone bluffs above. A white haze veiled the sun. Farmland yawned westward, while the river pressing south seemed to me the source and end of all the changing colors quilting the Illinois shore. "Read it me again," Mama said. Upriver, a cannon boomed from a trolling steamer, all but its twin stacks hidden by a thin, tree-lined island. "Madeline," she said. "Said wait by the river road. Don't see no other river, no other road." "Don't be smart," Mama said. She coiled a strand of hair around one finger, sucked the split ends to a point. She gave her skirts and petticoats a shake as one would freshen long shelf linen, and then we both became conscious of the figure hulking in the shade of a nearby oak. He was wide through the eyes, his chin studded with soft blonde whiskers and angry red blemishes, and his long arms and legs had a dumb, restless look about them. I slipped behind Mama, pulled my bonnet bow. "Miss Rebecca Branch," he said. Beautiful women like Mama only pretend to be unconscious of the effect their looks have upon men. On the train to Alton, her practiced scowl warded off uninvited attention, and the smile she gave this man, no, boy, a great big boy, slumping into the light, strained Mama's neck and shoulders. We'd been expecting a man with a steady business and dependable income, so his age and the frayed legs of his trousers were suspect. The cannon boomed. The boy, recovering himself, nodded toward the steam trail. "A girl's gone missing," he said. "That's terrible," Mama said. The boy shrugged. "If she's drowned, they're looking too far up current." He deliberated, craning his neck to see me. Isn't there only meant to be one of you? But Mama, stepping quickly in front, captured his full attention. And you are, Mr.? The boy blushed. It's Hanley. Just Hanley. Mr. Dreyfus' devil. Work for him, but I'm joining the fight out west soon as I'm old enough. Hanley, then, she said, and taking him by the sleeve, left me to mind the bags. Take us to Mr. Dreyfus. Even with her humble trousseau, Mama maintained the entire journey a desperate, hopeful pride which earned at once the slack-jawed admiration of men and the denigration of women, and made her even more a mystery to me than normal. In the days that must surely precede her wedding, she planned to stitch every scrap of lace she'd made about the collar and cuffs of her Sunday dress, in the hope that Mr. Dreyfus would find her attire frugal as opposed to poor. For in correspondence with Mr. Dreyfus' Mama, that is to say I, because Mama never learned to read or write well, led him to believe she stood to inherit a respectable sum and a modest estate from an aged aunt who, unfortunately, for all involved, did not exist. Except for her hands, square and calloused as a man's, Mama could pass for 20, but there was no benevolent aunt, no money, no land. And, of course, I did not yet exist in the mind of Mr. Dreyfus. No other advertisements in the matrimonial times featured mother with daughter, though plenty featured mutually attractive sisters, their hands full of daisies or knitting needles, sometimes a Bible. Mama decided. We both agreed. Better to make explanations as they became necessary. At the time, I thought little about omitting myself from the page and nothing of the fact that Lyman Dreyfus had included no photograph of himself when Mama had submitted too a profile and a portrait at great expense. His ad read simply, 254, a man of advancing age, adequate height and weight, with a steady business and dependable income, seeks energetic wife, fit and healthy, with a strong physiognomy, no Catholics. He was a man. He owned a house, a business. I liked the sound of his name, Lyman Dreyfus. Neither of us had known the meaning of the word physiognomy, got the widow with whom we had been living, and very much a mother to us both, decided it must mean beauty, a strong beauty, especially since there had been no other mention of appearances. Her dying wish was that we stay this side of the Mississippi, as if that muddy gash separating east from west would prove, even for her spirit, insurmountable, farther away than the spirit realm, where Dot's husband Sam had waited with far more patience, she said, than he'd ever managed in life. Dot needn't have worried. As from men living in the ethereal west promised riches with a brand of reckless confidence that made Mama wary. It was his letters, so passionate and generous next to the ad, which convinced me that Mama should, by all means, fall in love with Mr. Lyman Dreyfus. I hope you, too, he'd written, might one day learn to care for the river, to love the current's heavy pull, its murky, unreflective face, hiding alike her deeps and shallows, and in another, after the first snow in Reliance, but few leaves stop the eye short of the horizon. Plucked cornfields reveal blackened old woman's skin flaking and fallow, color drifts downriver, and after the shallows have frozen, before ice locks the riverbanks, the eagles come. Such a curious contradiction, the ice-locked riverbank and the fierce free flight of those eagles. He wrote about the sycamores and spring, the wind through the reeds, and I, who was then exceptionally sentimental, found it all terribly romantic, albeit unlike any of Dot's yellow-covered literature. I nevertheless felt confident in my reply. My dear Mr. Dreyfus, I wrote, my soul is sobbing and lamenting at the thought of our great distance, and I have been praying our separation willn't destroy my tender heart. I tipped my nose for the scent of mud earth, as Mr. Dreyfus described it, but smelled only the cannon sulfur leavings. I listened in vain for the soft whisper of his river reeds, could not differentiate stock sycamore from maple. I had expected the river to fit neatly into his description, but his words had become no more than stacked stones, and the river, its changing colors, its breath and constant motion, a living thing, quite apart. it made me afraid to meet him. And I'll stop there.
Oh, that's great. That was really good. I think it's a good opening. And of course, you know, I'd actually forgotten about that description of the river and the kind of poetic quality of his description of the town. And of course, you mentioned earlier that you had kind of been inspired by the river to tell this story in the first place. And I will say Mark Twain appears in the book, which I thought was kind of cool. So
yeah, he almost demanded it because he had been on the river in a raft, as far as I can tell, going from Hannibal, Missouri, where his hometown was, to St. Louis at approximately the time he shows up in my book. And he was researching Life on the Mississippi, the book in my back pocket for 4 years, and Huckleberry Finn. So,
right, he has to be there.
So when he has to be there. He almost demanded it, yeah. Right. And,
no,
of course,
great.
That poetic language, you know, once we meet Mr. Dreyfus, we come to doubt whether he's capable of such a thing,
right. Well,
such poetry.
Right. You would doubt almost anybody capable of that. So I think,
right.
You know, but everyone there, they're all kind of willfully living their illusions. So they have, mm-hmm. they have to continue on. They have no choice. And of course, that's where the story gets interesting. So
sure.
I think that we should leave it there so readers will be able to enjoy it for themselves. But I really want to thank you for taking some time to talk about your book. It's really, it's been great talking to you, and I really like the book.
Thank you.
It's called Reliance, Illinois. It's a novel. The author is Mary Vollmer, and this is David Wilk. I've been talking to Mary for Writer's Cast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.